Like to say thank you to start for all of the folks who've checked in and offered prayers and thoughts this past week. It's been an anxious few days for us, but as Pastor Andy said, Jubilee's now out of hospital and they'll be headed home next week. I don't know if you've ever been there, but we're looking forward to a little bit of normal again. I'm a bit of an astronomy enthusiast. Albeit a very, very amateur astronomy enthusiast. I love reading about space and stars and planets, learning about things like black holes and systems and galaxies. I find it all just really incredibly fascinating, all the wildness and vastness and beauty of the universe. I've also enjoyed learning a little bit about the history of astronomy, how the world has come, how humanity has come from its earliest understandings of the cosmos to everything we know and understand about the universe today. If you know anything about it, maybe from science or history classes, or maybe from your own reading, you'll know that the history of astronomy is marked by a number of revolutions. It's moved along by a number of profound shifts that have fundamentally altered the way that we've come to understand the universe and our place in it. So this morning I want to reflect briefly on one of those astronomical revolutions and explore how it might be a helpful metaphor. It might be a useful image as we think about this text and I think especially about the theme of music and worship in the life of the church. In 1514, a Polish writer and scientist named Nicholas Copernicus published a document called the Little Commentary. And what he described in this publication would come to mark one of the most significant shifts in scientific understanding to date. In this booklet, Copernicus challenged the idea that the Earth was at the center of the universe. Today, that probably seems like a given to us, a no-brainer. Of course, the Earth isn't at the center of the universe, right? Well, in Copernicus' day and in the centuries before him, nearly everyone thought otherwise. It was assumed that we as humans must be the center of the universe. The world was believed to be this unmoving point at the heart of the entire system. Hardly anyone questioned this, and if they did, they were thought to be out of their minds. The sun and all the planets and everything else that people saw when they looked up in the sky, all of that was thought to be spinning around us here on Earth. Through his careful study of the patterns he observed in the sky, Copernicus proved that our planets, of course, wasn't the center of the universe at all. He rightly argued that the Earth was part of a system of planets, a solar system, all of which spun around our big sun. Of course, there was much that he didn't know and didn't fully understand that we've since come to see, but what he put forward, what Copernicus put forward, ultimately represented and triggered this seismic shift in understanding for humanity. Shift in understanding that recognized that the world is not at the center. We're not at the center. You and I are not at the center of the universe. Through his observations and calculations, Nicholas Copernicus came to recognize and suggest that was another center to our system. That was the sun. He triggered this massive revolution in scientific thinking. I wonder if there's times when we could use a revolution like that. I wonder if our communities and our worlds could use a revolution like that some days. Because there's something I think so deeply ingrained in our natures, so hardwired into our systems, that makes us so very prone to thinking and acting like we are at the center or near the center. Reality, we know, is that that's all an illusion. Like the geocentric or earth-centric view of the universe that was held for centuries and centuries, we can believe that it's true and we can act as if it were true, but it simply is not true. To believe and behave as if it was is to either live in delusion or denial. We're not at the center. There's another center. So we could sometimes use a revolution in our understanding. I wonder if especially if we could use a revolution in our understanding when it comes to worship. If we could use a shift from a way of seeing and approaching music and song and worship as if we are somehow at or near the center of it all. Towards a recognition, a discovery, a rediscovery of the reality and a response to that reality of God as the true center, of Christ as our true center. I wonder if we, speaking more than and just us here today, speaking about Christian communities in general, could use a revolution like that. We get a bit of a glimpse of what that might look like and what that ultimately will look like in the book of Revelation. This morning, as we've heard, we're continuing our series that we're calling Worthy and exploring this wild and awfully wildly misunderstood and misrepresented collection of writing and seeing what it might show us about it, what it means to be worship, about what it might mean to be beings that make music and listen to music and sing together as a way of responding to God's, the God who created and redeemed us. This morning we'll be continuing to sift through all the symbolism and imagery and poetry and prophecy that are mixed together in these pages, focusing in on Revelation chapter 5. Last week, Pastor Randy, you'll remember, looked at chapter 4, where John, by God's Spirit, sees this vision of a heavenly throne. It's really just an overwhelming picture to consider, to imagine. Around the throne, we read, there are a number of strange and otherworldly creatures. And around them, there are more thrones, 24 of them, with 24 crowned figures dressed in white, seated on each of them. And as John continues describing this vision, it becomes clear that this is not a lifeless or static scene that he's beholding. There's movements. Things are happening here. All of these creatures and beings are worshiping the one that's on the throne. Continually, day and night, John writes, it's unceasing, unstopping, unbroken, eternal adoration. And it's all arranged in circles. Now, the center of all those circles is the throne and the one who's seated on the throne. And I believe that if we pay attention to that and if we recognize that and believe that and try to behave in our lives in light of that, it might lead to a kind of revolution in our lives, a revolution in the way that we understand worship and song and music. Because just like when Copernicus looked up at the heavens and realized that we're not at the center of things, John the Revelator looked at this bizarre and beautiful vision and saw something that was undeniably and unmistakably clear to him. He saw that we're not at the center. We're not at the center. You and I are not at the center. Humanity is not at the center. There is another center point to it all. We see the same thing here in chapter 5. Along with the imagery that John has already introduced in the chapter before, here there are new sights and sounds and symbols that he describes in these verses. There's an angel, as we've heard, and there's the one who's on the throne who has a scroll in his hands. And there's the one who's called the Lamb. And while he's watching all of this, John hears a question ring out. Who can open the scroll? And then there's this moment of despair. It seems that nobody can. The scroll is doomed to be sealed forever. It's hopeless. But just for a moment, until the word of reassurance comes, a word of hope. The one who's called the Lamb can do it. The one who's called the Lamb can open it. So John watches as this one who's called the Lamb goes to the throne and takes the scroll from the one who's sitting there. And in that instant, in that moment, the entire heavenly scene breaks out in worship. There's no one, not one being who doesn't join in. You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, they sing, because you were slain and with your blood you purchased for God's people from every tribe and language and people and nation. You made them to be a kingdom of priests to serve our God, and they will reign over the earth. It's this mysterious and majestic and deeply moving scene. You could go through each verse of each of these chapters and look at all the individual imagery and try to make sense of what it might have meant for those earliest Christians and what it might mean for us now. But for today, I want to focus in on just one aspect, one layer of this vision. I want to reflect on just one part of this Spirit-filled unveiling that John experienced on the island of Patmos. That's the fact that in this vision, we see circles. We see ever-widening circles, concentric circles, formed in succession one around another, all around a single fixed center. At the heart of it all, at the middle of it all, is the throne. And around the throne are the four heavenly creatures, and around them are the 24 elders. And around the 24 elders, John tells us, are angels. Thousands and thousands and thousands of angels, he writes, gathered around those who've already come and gathered around. When Nicholas Copernicus came to this realization about how our solar system worked, people began drawing diagrams that looked like this. They began drawing pictures of concentric circles, circles, around circles, showing the movement of all of our neighboring planets around the sun, which stood at the center. And when earnest and well-meaning and maybe at times misguided people have tried to make absolute literal sense of all of John's poetic and prophetic imagery here, it's come out looking surprisingly similar. They draw circles around circles around circles, all drawn around a single center point, the one who's on the throne, God who is enthroned. So the point, again, the point I want to focus on drawing out of this text today is simply this. We're not at the center. We're not at the center when it comes to the universe. We're not at the center when it comes to worship and music and song. So I wonder if there are times we could use a revolution like that. Because I believe that most, if not all of us, would say that we believe that we're not at the center. That a life of worship and all our practices of worship together are centered on God's. Like Copernicus's findings, we might hear that and say it's a given. It's obvious. Who doesn't believe that? Problem is, I think we can sometimes have a hard time truly seeing that, truly believing it, truly behaving as if it were true. Because again, there's something, I think, so deeply ingrained in our nature, so hardwired in our systems, that makes us so prone to thinking and acting like we were at the center. So we opt instead for maintaining the illusion. We try to fight against the pull of spiritual gravity and somehow swing our way out of orbits and move to the middle instead. We find ourselves trying our hardest to make things turn around us or around others when it comes to this, to worship and song. I believe you can see this really clearly if you pay attention to the kind of language that people sometimes use when they talk about music and song in the life of the church. You see it when people sometimes move from church community to church community. If you're new to church or faith, some of this might sound a bit foreign. My apologies. If you're new to this all, it's probably a bit foreign that we'd gather together and sing in the first place. It's kind of strange when you think about it. But if you've been part of Christian community for any length of time, this kind of language will sound familiar, likely. We hear words like preference or tastes or cater or entertain and needs and appeal to and gear towards and priority and attracts and getting or not getting or giving or having to give up. And if you're paying attention, we hear all of that. When we hear all of that, we can begin to recognize that we're working with a view of worship of the universe in which we and not gods are at the center. Just a problem, right? Because as much as we might like to believe and behave as if it were true, it simply is not. We are not. It simply isn't true to reality as we know it. You're not the center. I'm not the center. The center of the universe. There's another center to the system and to our worship. It's really important to recognize that the solution isn't to simply try and rearrange which of us is at the center. It's something I've often heard over my years of work. We need balance. It's not a matter of switching at one human center point for another. One group or another feels neglected or pushed to the side, and so we move them to the center instead. Kind of displace the existing center and plan around a new one instead. Try to make the system rotate in motion around them instead. I think many people might say, I don't care about me, but can we do this for them? Which might reflect noble and selfless intentions, but I believe in the end often serves to reinforce the limits of the old us-centered view. Or might try to have the system somehow rotate around everyone. We try to make sure there's somehow something for everyone. And it becomes this really odd and strange dance of planets, attempting to each spin around one another and inevitably colliding, we know, with one another from time to time in the process. I hope you hear me carefully when I say that it's so important and so critical and so necessary for each generation to be able to worship in ways that reflect their realities and their experiences. Something I feel deeply about and have worked really hard for and continue to work hard for. It's just when that's all you seem to be talking about or working for, when that's the primary thing guiding conversation and practices, we're not moving any closer to true worship than before, no matter what you choose to move around. In fact, I believe that when you do that, when you approach worship and song in a way that's you or I or they or we or whoever is seen to be at the center, it's not just a matter of it being a false or unrealistic view of worship. Something much more heartbreaking, maybe spiritually troubling, that it's a form of idolatry. Because idolatry, by definition, is taking something that's not God and shifting it, placing it at the center of your life and worship instead. It's when our lives, in my life, we're continually invited away from that into this kind of Copernican revolution. It's a revolution of decentering, a revolution of recognition and response to our true center. When Nicholas Copernicus published his findings about the sun rather than the earth being at the center of the system, people were upset, to say the least. He was promptly and flatly condemned and denounced by all manner of philosophers, scientists, and church leaders. They all found his idea far too troubling. It was controversial. It was too disturbing to be true. It just didn't line up. It simply could not be true. We know that this continued in a significant way all the way through to the 20th century. In my lifetime, even, I've met and talked to people who believe in earnest that the earth is at the center of the universe. It's wild, because how could it be any other way? And so when we talk about this, I recognize that it might very well be upsetting or disorienting or distressing or uncomfortable. Because again, like Copernicus, we live in a world that is in so many ways wanting to still believe that we are at the center. But if we're at all concerned with seeing reality as it truly is and living and worshiping in a way that lines up with that, this sort of shift is going to be critical. And this can be distressing or disorienting, yes. It can sometimes feel like there's a risk of losing our identity, our sense of self, the things that matter to us in the process. Yet I believe there's something profoundly revealing and liberating about it. When you think about it, it's hard to imagine people quarreling about this all when we think of the heavenly images that John describes for us in this book, right? Why is that? It's not because there's no difference or diversity in this vision. John describes people from every generation, language, and culture, and time and place gathered together. You can't get any more diversity and difference packed into a place than that. So when we talk about this, it's not about needing to erase or ignore all of those things, our experiences, our personalities, our preferences, our places in time and history. Instead, I believe it's because in this vision, all of the heavenly beings and saints and angels see with a perfect and holy clarity the one who's at the center. I believe it's because they're so fully enraptured, so captivated with every ounce of their beings by the object of their worship, that all those things that might have felt so important and so personal before have simply been forgotten. They've all dissolved into the overwhelming glory and beauty of God that they behold. They've all but been forgotten in the fullness of the presence of the eternal Christ that they now experience. So in this vision, you don't see people talking about language or preference or style. You don't have anyone walking out or politicking or grumbling about things. You see people who are far too captivated and far too concerned, far more concerned and consumed with a loving devotion for who they're worshiping than they are with questions of how they're worshiping. You have a people fully decentered. You have people circled in praise around the one on the throne. You have every knee bowed and every tongue confessing, every tongue singing. Worthy is the Lamb who is slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise. When I was in high school, a kind and gentle elder of the church I grew up in once sat down and talked to me about some things. I wanted a visit. Music and worship came up. This man has since passed away, but that day he told me that he was fine with singing newer songs. I think he may have even mentioned that he listened to them on the radio from time to time. But I just don't like it when they repeat over and over, you know, he said. I told him he might have a problem with all the holy, holy, holies that John tells us are belted out on repeat for all eternity. I was a bit angstier back then, a bit of a pain. Despite that, I understood what he meant, and to his credit, he was sympathetic to the whole new song piece, which is part of this vision as well. You can go back and read that in verse 9 if you missed it. I think I was mostly frustrated in all my teenage angst in that moment about something that's frustrated me many times since. It's this way of thinking and talking and acting about worship and song that seems to be blind to the true center of our lives and our worship, in a way that seems to altogether forget or ignore the reality of who it is that we're worshiping, which is the very reason why we worship and sing in the first place. It's a response to God and what God has done, and as a way of seeking what God might yet do in the world and our lives. Author and scholar Marv Vidon once wrote, "The greatest danger of choosing where or at which type of service we worship according to our musical taste is that we forget that worship is for God." Worship is for God. It seems obvious, right? It's as obvious as the fact of the sun sitting up in the sky above us. And yet sometimes, for some reason, we somehow lose sight of the bright and blazing light and life-giving center. So I wonder, again, if some days, some of us, if I could use a revolution. I've used this idea of a Copernican revolution as a way of processing my own journey through marriage and parenthood. If any of you have been married or parents, you'll know exactly what I mean. When you get married or become a parent, you all of a sudden have a new center, a new point of gravity to your life's universe, a new fixed middle points around things which things now revolve. It can be a difficult transition to make. It can be something you find yourself pushing against from time to time. Because I quite like being the center of my life's universe, thank you very much. But you also have this beautiful being that's now at the center of your life. Someone so incredible to hold and behold. Someone that you can cherish and see and love and adore. Share life with. There's a deep wonder and joy in that, and you can't help be moved by that, decentered and swung into a new orbit by it. In the end, I believe that any satisfaction of getting what I want or prefer or think is right when it comes to music and song is going to seem so utterly puny, so completely petty and insignificant compared to the all-surpassing satisfaction of seeing and encountering the risen, exalted Christ, the true center of our worship. Can't imagine any of that mattering all that much, thinking about everything that John describes here, imagining that all, despite how much it can seem to matter for me and others some days. Something incredibly freeing when we're able to decenter. We no longer have to exhaust ourselves trying to make things whirl around us or anyone else. When we're able to let some of that go and stand in awe of the powerful presence that sits in the center of it all. When we're able to be moved in the deepest parts of ourselves by its gravity, to circle and cycle around it again and again in joyous praise. There's something incredibly freeing and good about that. Something about that that's so deeply resonant with what we were created for. Can you hear me clearly? I believe that we can worship as churches with as much diversity of expression and style and language, that we should do that with as much diversity of expression and style and language as we can. But we cannot do that if any particular expression or style is more important to us or more necessary to us than the one who's called the Lamb and the one who sits on the throne. Again, as much as we might sometimes find ourselves struggling against it, I believe there's something deeply compelling about this kind of revolution, this discovering and rediscovering of God as our true center. Again, we can stop and think about the language that we sometimes use and sometimes hear when we talk about times of worship, times of singing, those times that we find most powerful and meaningful. We might talk about experiences of transcendence, of losing yourself, experiences of forgetting yourself, of being lifted. We might talk about times when we felt like we're participating in something much more expansive than ourselves. Or we might talk about times when we've had this experience of joining in with something together with others. I believe these are all ways of talking about having seen and responded to something much, much bigger than ourselves. The words spoken, words shared, having seen and encountered God, the true center. The words spoken by people who have been decentered, who've experienced a kind of spiritual revolution. And I heard every creature, John writes, every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that's in them, saying, to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and honor and glory and power forever and ever. Amen.